Mark chapter 12 is a chapter of questions. Jesus is asked so many questions in this particular chapter, and it's very interesting to go through each of them. It actually the questioning starts all the way back in chapter 11, where the people ask him, well, the Pharisees, I should say, ask him, and the chief priests, excuse me, the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders ask him where he gets his authority. And then he goes on and tells gives a parable, and then people try to trap him even more. We see the Pharisees and the Herodians we talked about last week try to trap him with the question of should we pay taxes to Caesar or shouldn't we? And Jesus brilliantly answered that question far better than I would ever have. Now that the Pharisees have had their shot, the Sadducees, it's their turn to ask a particular question. So, as we look at this, it's Mark chapter 12. This is on a Tuesday. This is the Tuesday of Jesus's last week of his life, or at least during his before his crucifixion, let's put it that way. And then we see that the idea here, the question is based on the resurrection. So let's go ahead and try to well, let's actually, we're not going to try to, we're going to read this passage, Mark chapter 12 verses 18 through 27, and then we'll go and we'll discuss it. We'll talk about what has gone on here. All right. So let's read Mark chapter 12 verses 18 through 27. Then some Sadducees who say there is no resurrection came to him, and they asked him, saying, "Teacher, Moses wrote to us that if a man's brother dies and leaves his wife behind and leaves no children, his brother should take his wife and raise up offspring for his brother. Now there were seven brothers. The first took a wife, and dying, he left no offspring. And the second took her, and he died. Nor did he have any offspring, and the third likewise. So the seven had her and left no offspring. Last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrection, when they rise, whose wife will she be? For all seven had her as wife." Jesus answered and said to them, "Are you not therefore mistaken, because you do not know the scriptures nor the power of God? For when they rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. But concerning the dead that they rise, have you not read in the book of Moses and the burning bush passage, how God spoke to him, saying, 'I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living. You are therefore greatly mistaken.'" All right, so hello, Laura. Good to see that you've at least dropped in on us. We're thankful for your being here. All right. So, looking at this passage. All right, Mark chapter 12, verse 18 through 27. We're going to discuss the Sadducees. Who are they? What exactly are we talking about here? And just. What is going on? Who are these people? Well, the Sadducees decide they're going to take a stab at Jesus, at least asking him questions, trying to see if he is on the up and up, and try to figure out what kind of questions they could ask him. This is a particular party, a sect of the Jews at this time. Of course, the main ones that we see talked about in the scriptures are the Pharisees and the Sadducees. We read about the Herodians last week. There's another one that the scriptures don't talk about called the Essenes, but they crop up a lot in when studying history in this time period. And I'm sure there are others that I can't place right now, but these are the main ones, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So they decide that they're going to pop up, and they are in the minority. That's one thing to consider. They are in the minority among the people, and they were primarily among the elites. We see in Acts chapter 4, now we see them pop up a couple times in the book of Acts. Acts chapter 4, verses 1 and inform us, now as they spoke to the people, this is when Peter is speaking to the people there around the temple, after he had spoken to them. Now as they spoke to the people, the priests, the captain of the temple, and the Sadducees came upon them, being greatly disturbed, and they taught the people and preached in Jesus the resurrection from the dead. And of course, they were disturbed by that. And of course, we read just now in verse 18 that they say there is no resurrection in chapter Mark chapter 12, verse 18. In chapter 5 and verse 17 of the book of Acts, we see, and the high priest rose up and all who were with him, which is the sect of the Sadducees, and they were filled with indignation. So we note that they were, again, a minority among the people, but they were among the elites. They were the bigwigs, if you will. And we'll see why that is in a second. And of course, given the beliefs of this particular sect, that they believe that they don't believe in the resurrection, that they don't believe in an afterlife, essentially, they don't believe in angels or spirits or anything of that nature, then it makes sense that they were that only the upper echelons of society would hold these views, because then there is no hope. All the reward they have is here on this earth, and so they will get all the power and wealth that they can. And so again, it makes sense that only the upper echelons would hold these beliefs. Mark and Luke only mentioned them once here in this particular passage, and of course, it's concerning this same event here. Matthew mentions them several times, and especially being in league with the Pharisees. And Acts provides us with a little bit more information, of course, about them and about how they interact sometimes. One of their key defining beliefs, as we see in Acts chapter 23 and verse 8 as well, is that they lack a belief in, it's really a lack of belief, not just a belief, but a lack of belief in the resurrection of the dead. And of course, that's very much on display here. But also in Acts chapter 23 and verse 8, they don't believe in angels or spirits, as I mentioned earlier. And of course, if there are no angels or spirits, and if there is no resurrection, the only rewards or consequences that you have are here on this earth. And again, that would appeal to the elites. Josephus also indicates that they only believed in the works of Moses. They didn't believe that the works past Moses, Joshua through Malachi, were inspired by God, or at least they didn't believe that they belonged in the Bible. They didn't hold them to be authoritative. And this is important concerning Jesus's response to the question that we'll see here, or that we have read just now. All right. So we'll note that this is meant to be another gotcha question, a question that has no good answer, and they're really trying to figure out a way to stump Jesus, a way to figure out how to catch him in some kind of mistake or lie or some incoherent response or something inconsistent with his other beliefs or inconsistent with the scriptures. They're really trying to get him. And that's not only that, but trying to anger him against the people. And so that's especially what happened with the Pharisees and Herodians in the last section. So they're really trying to stump Jesus. And again, we saw how, well, we saw and they saw how handily Jesus answered the gotcha question last time from the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So they decide, well, we're going to take a crack at it. We're going to see what this guy has to say about it. They are, of course, they are just as interested in debunking Jesus as the Pharisees are. And of course, We one of the questions, one of the things that one might come at, one of the conclusions one might come by reading this particular question is that this is very likely a stock hypothetical scenario that they often posed to the Pharisees and others who believed in the resurrection. And they think that it's something that proves their position, something that proves their position. And it's an odd question if you're not familiar with this particular custom that's talked about here, but it's based on the concept of what's called a levirate marriage, if I'm pronouncing that right. A levirate marriage, and it's named for the Latin word for husband's brother or brother-in-law if you're the mother, or if you're the wife of the man talked about. And it really has nothing to do with Levites, despite the fact that it kind of sounds like it. It's spelled Levirate. So it sounds like it might be having something to do with Levi or the Levites, but in fact it does not. It comes from, again, from that Latin word for husband's brother. So levirate marriage. Now we can find that custom codified in the Old Testament in Deuteronomy chapter 25. Verses 5 through 6. We saw the custom, if you recall, all the way in Genesis chapter 37, I believe, where, or maybe it's 38, chapter 38, Genesis 38, when Judah, has, three sons, and his, and he has hit the first one, the eldest, marries a woman. He dies having no children, gives her to his brother. So that's Onan and Shelah, the brothers. And then, unfortunately, well, Onan dies. Dies. He was a wicked man. He dies, married to Tamar. Tamar is given to Onan. Onan dies, for not fulfilling his obligations in the levirate marriage. And Tamar is then held for Shelah when he becomes of age. And then some things happen. I don't want to get into that, but we see that that is a very a custom that was cultural at the time, and also then codified in the Old Testament law in Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 5 and 6. But the purpose of this law was to preserve the name of the man who had died in Israel. We note, and I have on here as well, that it's not mentioned specifically in Ruth, but it is assumed. It is the custom that is understood in the book of Ruth. She participated in this particular custom when she married Boaz, who was said to be a close relative. And she was married to Mahlon, who had died. And so his brother, Mahlon's brother, also died, and so they had to find, they were supposed to find a close relative. The closest was unwilling to marry Ruth, and so Boaz was able to take up that responsibility. We see that primarily in Ruth chapter 4. All right. So this is the argument that the Sadducees make here is in logical circles, it's called reductio ad absurdum. It literally means reducing a point to its most absurd or ridiculous conclusion. Boy, if it's true with one, if it's true with one situation where it goes to the brother, then it's got to be true with the second, third, fourth, fifth, all the way down to the seventh. It's got to be true for that whole situation. You've got to look at the whole conclusion, the whole implications of a particular law. And so, they say, because this reductio ad absurdum, because this argument makes so much sense, the Sadducees say this, then clearly there must not be a resurrection, because then whose wife would she be in eternity? Well, the question here is, do you have to go? The question I have is, do you have to go up to seven husbands for this poor woman, or are two sufficient to make your point? Two is a quandary. Seven is ridiculous. So two is again a quandary, a question you have to figure it out. But seven again is ridiculous. Getting to that ad absurdum part, reductio ad absurdum argument. An example that we might face today of such an argument is concerning God's omnipotence. Maybe you've heard the question: since God is omnipotent, can he make a rock so big that he cannot himself lift it? Well, that's an absurd argument, isn't it? Such arguments are actually a good way. Generally speaking, a reductio ad absurdum argument is a good way in order to get someone to really think about their positions and the logical implications of what it means. But it only works if you have the facts on your side. The question I posed just now, can God make a rock so big that he himself cannot lift it? It ignores the nature of God, and it ignores the fact that he's a non-corporeal, he's a spiritual being. And so the answer is no, he can't do that. It goes against his nature. It's like he's fighting against himself. It doesn't make any sense. It is an illogical argument. And that's the same here with this particular thing, as Jesus will respond with that later. Jesus would have likely responded to this gotcha question the same way he did with this one from the Sadducees. We recognize, because the question, I'm someone who asks that question about who can he make a rock so big. I might say a good response to that would be, you're therefore mistaken, not knowing the scriptures nor the power of God. And I think that's the case. That's a good response if we want to give one for someone who might ask that question. We recognize, or at least Jesus recognizes, that this is an ignorant question. The question, the reductio ad absurdum, shortened reductio, argument that the Sadducees make is absurd. It's an ignorant question. They don't know the scriptures. They don't know the power of God. And it's because of that they ask this ignorant question. Do people ask ignorant questions? Well, yeah, all the time people ask them. We have to find a way in order to talk to them in a logical and a calm manner in order for them to be had to ask better questions, so they don't ask such ridiculous questions. All right, so again, this is an ignorant question. Jesus again starts off his response by saying that they are indeed mistaken, and ends by saying that they are greatly mistaken. We see that at the end in verse 27. You're not just mistaken, you are greatly mistaken. He doesn't mince words there, does he? Do we ever just call out somebody and said, "No, nah, you're wrong, man." No. That's kind of what Jesus is doing here. You see, they don't realize who they are talking to. What does Jesus call himself in John chapter 11 verse 25? He is the resurrection and the life. Basically, if he is the resurrection and the life, well, then these Sadducees, questioning the very possibility of a resurrection, question Jesus's very existence, since he is indeed the resurrection and the life. They are these Sadducees, they are the elites, and no doubt they think that they have, oh, sorry. No doubt they think that they are so smart to have thought their way. Excuse me. They no doubt think that they are so smart, having thought their way out of this basic teaching of scripture that is treated as absolute fact by both Jesus and Martha in their discussion in John chapter 11, after her brother Lazarus had died. There is no doubt how atheists feel when they pose their own gotcha questions, like the one I asked earlier. I think the word that one might that one could describe them is smug. Someone who thinks that they're so smart. I figured you out. I mean, how can you believe in a God? Here's this question that's so simple. Even a child can understand it. And they get so smug with their ideology that they think that they've figured it out. And indeed they profess to be wise, but indeed they are fools, as we see in Romans chapter 1 and verse 22. And that's the case here with the Sadducees as well. But really, such an ignorant question, the one I asked earlier. Omnipotence doesn't mean that you can do anything. Now, some might think it does mean you can do anything, but it really doesn't. It means that you can do anything that is logically consistent with your character. Something that is logically consistent with your character. While God is omnipotent, he cannot lie. We see in Mark chapter 10 and verse 27 and Titus chapter 1 and verse 2, Jesus and God, they cannot lie. Jesus in Mark chapter 10, verse 27, we see the omnipotence of God, but in Titus chapter 1 and verse 2, God cannot lie. We'll talk about that more this evening. So, no, he cannot create a rock so big he can't lift it. And more to the point, why would he even try? It's not like we can really place such physical limitations on a spiritual being in the first place. And so Jesus, in response to this question, Jesus answers in such a way that completely undercuts the Sadducees' position, saying that they just don't know the scriptures or the power of God. Have you ever had an argument or a discussion with somebody and you feel like the rug has just been pulled out from under you? You realize, man, I have no argument now. That's completely been debunked. And so sometimes I have to think, that doesn't seem right. I have to figure this out. But sometimes it's true. Sometimes that does happen to me sometimes. All right. I see Carol's on here. Hello, Carol. We note that Jesus says that they are like the angels, that they are like the angels. That's an interesting thing to consider, being like the angels. What does that mean to be like the angels? This particular thing corresponds to Jesus's charge that the Sadducees, they don't know the power of God. So there's two things here. They don't know the power of God and they don't know the scriptures. The argument that Jesus uses concerning the angels is in reference to the fact that they don't know the power of God. Let's consider the power of God here. First off, I want you to think about something for just a moment. In your marriage vows, what phrase do we say that speaks as to the duration of the marriage? What is it? Till death do us part, right? Till death do us part. It doesn't go beyond death. Now, I don't know if that's what they said in the marriage vows in ancient Jerusalem and ancient Judea, but that's common sense, isn't it? Well, at least we think it is. So, but in any event, once a married person has died, the widow or the widower is now technically single. The marriage has effectively ended. As much as we might hate that idea. Second, we have to ask ourselves what the purpose of marriage is. And would marriage be something that's needed in heaven? Recall in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 18 that after God had created man, he said, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him." So God created woman and the institution, and by default, the institution of marriage as a result of creating woman after having created man. So my question, and this is my discussion question for the day, do you think that we'll ever be lonely in heaven? Adam was the only man on earth, and he was lonely. Do you think that we'll ever be lonely in heaven? Do you think that we'll ever need a helper comparable to us to get through essentially eternal life? Is that something that we're going to need? Sam, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think, first of all, we're going to be in the presence of God, and I think that's going to be so amazing. That's God is going to be with us. It says He will be their God. He will be in the midst of us, and so we won't be alone. If there was no one else there but us and God, that would be enough. But there's already millions of angels. There are many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Christians. There's millions upon millions upon millions of babies that have died in innocence, and children that have died in innocence. We're not going to be worried about that. I really don't think so.
Well, that also brings me another question that I've always wondered, which I don't know. It's not necessarily a silly question, but what will we look like in heaven? Are we going to appear as we died, or are we going to appear? Are we going to appear? What's the word? In our prime, something of that nature. What does that mean for babies? What does that mean for the elderly? And so again, that's a question that's similar to how many angels can fit on the head of a pin. It's not really an important question. Yeah, it's not really an important question. But it is just one of the things in the back of my mind that I have. That's just, what is that going to be like? You know, and we don't really know. We just know we'll have glorified bodies. And what exactly that means, I don't know. But what we do see is, will we need that companionship in heaven? Well, no, I think God will be our companion. And there's going to be no sorrow, no struggle there. And we will find ultimate rest. We'll find ultimate rest up there. And man, that's a great thing. And I look forward to that. And I'm glad that, you know, if my wife and I remain faithful, that she'll be up there. But that we'll be up there, and we might be together or near each other. But will I need that companionship? And the answer, no. Because we have God. We'll be in the presence of the Lord. Other questions and speculations arise with this passage. And just like I mentioned earlier, some of the questions I have, but of course it's beyond the scope of this class. We can't go through all those questions and whatnot. But does it mean then that we won't recognize our loved ones? Does it mean that we won't be with our families? Well, again, those questions, who knows? Who knows what that means? But we know that we'll be like the angels in heaven. So all I know is that things will be so different for us that we can't even fathom what it would look like. We just don't know. Yes.
Like you said, there's not a lot written in the scriptures of details about that, but we have a few interesting hints. For instance, we know that the rich man and Lazarus, knew each other. The rich man remembered that he had brothers. That he was saying Father Abraham. He recognized Abraham. You know, there's some little tidbits, and that's all we've got. But one thing for sure, being in the presence of God, you just think about the scenes of praise of God, or millions of angels and all the saved singing praises to God. We're not going to be by ourselves up there, and we're going to be so overwhelmed, I think, with the amazing glory of God and our love and praise and joy for that we won't be worried about other things. I think that's what it means when it says there's no more tears. I don't believe that we won't necessarily have any memories, because we have the rich man who remembered his brothers, but I think that it won't matter, because we'll be so overwhelmed with joy.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, you know, I was thinking that that. Oh, I had a good thought. Now it's gone. I hate it when that happens. In any event, we're going to be with the Lord, aren't we? And I can't think of anything better than that. We don't know what exactly will what heaven will be like. And all I know is I'd like to go there. I'd like to be there. One more thing to note here. I'm trying to remember what I was going to say because it was really good. we'll move on. One more thing to note here, though, is that Jesus is describing when he says that we'll be like the angels in heaven. Now, what does that mean? He's describing the proper domain of angels, that they're not married nor given to marriage. It does not mean, though, that they cannot leave. That angels, now I don't know about us when we in the resurrection, when we are raised again, but it does mean that the angels, it does not mean that the angels could not leave their proper domain, but they were certainly punished for it. We see that in various passages like Jude verses 6 and 7 and 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4. The angels had left their proper domain, and as a result, they were punished for it. And so that's something to consider as well. And I can get into a whole thing on that, but I don't think you want me to. That's a whole other ball of wax, a whole other can of worms. I don't think I want to get into at the moment. In any event, the next one, he answers the question, or he corresponds and says, "You don't know the scriptures." And so that's with the idea that the I have on here, I am God, and recognizing that particular present tense that we have with the with this particular phrase and how important that is. So Jesus, he goes to the works of Moses. He goes to the first five books of the Bible to prove his next point, proving that they don't know the scriptures. Recall that the Sadducees, they only accepted these books as from God. I made a bit of a mistake. I think it was last week when I was looking at when I was preaching on Hebrews chapter, well, last few verses of chapter 5 and the first few verses of chapter 6. I made a bit of a mistake, and I apologize for that, where the Bible, the Old Testament, did not specifically mention a resurrection. In fact, it does. And I came across this later, and I'm like, oh man, there it is right there. And that's in a passage in Daniel chapter 12 and verse 2. There is indeed a passage that talks about it in the prophets, but the Sadducees didn't accept the prophets as scripture. And so because they didn't accept the prophets as scripture, Jesus went to the old law, went to the first five books. And at the same time, we can go to all manner of passages that talk about how the dead have not ceased to exist. And I have on here 1 Samuel chapter 28. That talks of Samuel's spirit arising to speak with King Saul. His spirit existed. His spirit, I mean, what did the Sadducees think? That was some fable that somebody made up? Why would it be in the Bible? But instead, Jesus, instead of going to 1 Samuel 28 or Daniel chapter 12, instead, Jesus goes to a phrase that is oft quoted in Scripture. And not only that, but where God introduces himself to Moses in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 6. He says, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. I am this God. Man, that's powerful. And we don't realize exactly what that means. except for what Jesus says here. What it means, well, we'll see in a second what it means. By the time Moses had come to the burning bush, these three patriarchs were long dead. And I have their passages of where they had died. Genesis 25 and verse 8, Abraham dies. Chapter 35 and verse 29, Isaac dies. And chapter 49, verse 33, Jacob dies. These three men, these three patriarchs, had long died. But the present tense that we see, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that is important. God didn't say, I was the God of your fathers, but I am the God of your fathers. This is an indication that these patriarchs are still alive in some sense. Obviously, their bodies are dead. I mean, they were buried, right? But their souls live on. Their souls live on in some fashion. Abraham himself speaks in what Jesus says in Luke chapter 16, verse 19. I had the verse on there, but if you recall, that's the story of the rich man and Lazarus. The story of the rich man and Lazarus. Abraham speaks in that particular event. As a result, we see God is a God of the living and not of the dead. These patriarchs, and by extension, all mankind, have not and do not cease to exist. We continue to live on. We continue to live on in some fashion. Anyone who has seen Jesus raise someone up from the dead, can attest to that. Of course, we saw Peter, James, and John did in Mark chapter 5 with the little girl. The son of, or the daughter of Jairus, the ruler of the synagogue. We saw that in Mark chapter 5. We saw that in Lazarus in John chapter 11. Of course, Lazarus was the latest and the most public example of his ability to raise people from the dead. Of course, it's not recorded here in Mark, but we do see it in John chapter 11. You see, they were asking a question. These Sadducees were asking a question about the resurrection to the resurrection and the life himself. In the next passage, which I don't think we have time to get into, in the next passage, we'll talk about what appears to be a softball question, but still a very vital question from a scribe. What is the great commandment of the law, which is the first commandment of all, he says here in Mark's version here. So we'll get that next week. Man, this is a powerful study here in the resurrection and how important it is for us to understand and how important it is to recognize that this isn't the end. What we see here in this life is not the end. But in fact, it's only the beginning. Sam, did you have any thoughts? I thought I heard you heard something over there.
No. Looking forward to the rest of it.
Okay. All right. Well, we've got a couple minutes left, and you know, if you have any thoughts or questions or anything that you'd like to pose. All right. I do see Carol's here, and Valerie and Neil are listening. So glad that you're here with us today. Hope Neil's doing okay. Well, I still haven't remembered what I was going to think of earlier. I think it had to do with something that Sam had said, so I don't necessarily want to have him repeat what he said, because he might not remember everything either. But in any event, there are so many questions that we have about the end, about what heaven is going to be like. And the Bible doesn't give us a whole lot of details, doesn't give us a whole lot of things like that. And largely, I think it's because our mind would be blown. We wouldn't understand. Oh, I remember what I was going to say now. Look at that. I remembered finally with 2 minutes left in class. All right. So he asked the question, would we be able to recognize each other? Or at least, I don't know if he asked the question, but he kind of hinted at that particular idea. Would we be able to recognize one another? Well, you know how in dreams, I don't know if you experience this, but in dreams, and of course I know this isn't reality, but it's something that, if it's true in dreams, why not be true in reality or in heaven? In dreams, do you ever recognize someone? Say, oh, this is so and so, but then you think about it later and it's like, wait, that person didn't look anything like this person that they're supposed to be, but you recognize them. There may be, I think there may be some way that we'll be able to tell who we each are without necessarily having to base our recognition on outward appearance. Now, again, I'm speculating there, but I don't think it's a bad speculation. I like the idea that when we get to heaven, we'll never have the problem of forgetting someone's name. Because that is definitely a problem that I deal with sometimes, and maybe you do too. I don't know. Sam, do you have a thought?
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, it's a. I find it very interesting sometimes to imagine what it would be like in heaven. And we have some examples and some guidance and stuff, and not a lot of details, like you say. But one of the things that I think would be part of the joy of heaven is to see those brothers and sisters who've made it. To be able, I mean, and it's not that we'll like I said, we have different bodies, so I'm not thinking physical remembrance here. But even just for someone to come up and tap you on the shoulder and say, you taught me the gospel those many years ago, and it's because of that that I'm here. I mean, I can imagine the joy of that. There's definitely some people who helped lead me to Christ that I want to see. I want to be at the table with them. I want to sing with them. I think that's part of the joy of being there is with those of like precious faith. I think that's going to be part of it. But like I said, that's speculation.
Yeah, I'm thinking mainly of children who died in infancy or who were miscarried or something of that nature. How would you know whether or not who that person is, because you've either never seen them or they would look very different. I think, I think in my mind, a parent who has gone up to heaven and sees their child, but just recognizes them and be like, man, that's a, I don't know. It's just a remarkable, and a remarkable thing to consider, just that kind of reunion. You have no idea what that's going to be like, but I imagine it's going to be amazing. Of course, the main thing we're concerned about, not necessarily the reunion with our loved ones, but our reunion and our fellowship with the Lord. That's the important thing to consider. Joy says, aren't the bodies all the same? Same as what? Same as each other, or same as ours in life? I don't know. I do know that there is some difference that's going to be made. We see that in 1 Corinthians 15, but what exactly that means, I have no idea.
And John says that whatever body we have, it'll be like his. It'll be like Jesus. But I don't think that means we're all identical.
Well, at the same time, Jesus, one of the problems that I see with that, and I with that particular interpretation of that is we're a little over time, but is Jesus still had the scars in his hands and his feet and in his side where he was pierced. The idea then would be anyone who was an amputee will be without a limb up in heaven. Anyone who
who
then you'd have to deal with people who were crushed or burned,
exactly,
or whatever else, right?
Yeah,
and that's a great example, by the way, of reductio ad absurdum. Just take it to the extreme; it can be very useful. But in the first chapter of the Book of Revelation, Jesus appears to John in a glorified state, and he's described there very different than he ever looked on Earth. So you know, there's that too. But like I said, it's tiny little hints. You know, no real clear descriptions.
True, but I'm not sure exactly how to take Revelation 1 in terms of Jesus' appearance, since that's an allegorical book, and is that how things really will be, or is it symbolic of something greater, like a sword coming out of his mouth? I don't think we'll have literal swords coming out of our mouths. So there's some changes, some understanding of the allegorical nature of Revelation and how exactly that relates to the idea of our appearance in the afterlife. Anyway, we're off in speculation land right now. Let's go ahead and, unless Sam, you have any other thoughts, let's go ahead and close out so we can get on with our Bible, with our worship service in just a little bit. I got some in my eyes, so it's not going away. Yeah. All right. So thank you all for joining us here this evening. Come back in just a few minutes as we start our live stream for our evening worship. Thank you all, and we'll see you in just a moment. God bless.